A messy press conference today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. President Trump held a press conference this afternoon, and he was combative from start to finish.
To be honest, I inherited a mess. It's a mess.
And as for all the talk of improper contacts with Russia,
it's all fake news.
Meanwhile, Trump's performance gets good reviews on Russian state media.
Russian people are now very confused. Only a few months ago, they were told that America is Russia's greatest enemy. Suddenly, they are told, you know, Trump is a great thing.
Plus, a doctor in Canada who helps refugees because it's the right thing to do.
And the public support for the work we're doing, it suggested and confirmed that I believe we are a compassionate nation.
That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. A presidency in chaos after less than a month in office. Confusion and infighting within the administration. Allies around the world nervous about their relations with America. President Trump's not buying any of that. He came out swinging today at a contentious press conference. A testy Trump blamed the news media for fabricating this narrative of confusion and claimed that despite what the press is telling the American public, his administration is running like a fine-tuned machine.
I don't think there's ever been a president elected who in this short period of time has done what we've done.
Trump also lashed out at Democrats and the previous administration.
To be honest, I inherited a mess. It's a mess. At home and abroad, a mess.
When it came time for questions, things got even nastier. Here's an exchange with one of our BBC colleagues.
Can I just ask you, thank you very much, Mr. President.
Where are you from?
BBC.
Okay. Here's another beauty.
It's a good line. Impartial, free and fair.
Yeah, sure.
Mr. President.
Just like CNN, right?
On the travel ban, we could banter back and forth. On the travel ban, would you accept that that was a good example of the smooth running of government?
Yeah, I do. Let me tell you about the travel.
Were there any mistakes
in that? Wait. I know who you are. Just wait. Let me tell you about the travel ban. We had a very smooth rollout of the travel ban, but we had a bad court.
Many of the questions, though, centered on Russia and about the scandal swirling around the amount of contact between Trump staffers and Russian officials during the campaign.
You know, you can talk all you want about Russia, which was all a, you know, fake news fabricated deal to try and make up for the loss of the Democrats, and the press plays right into it. In fact, I saw a couple of the people that were supposedly involved with all of this, but they know nothing about it. They weren't in Russia. They never made a phone call to Russia. They never received a phone call. It's all fake news. It's all fake news.
Trump was also asked point blank about his own role in the scandal surrounding National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and his contacts with a Russian diplomat.
Did you direct Mike Flynn to discuss sanctions with the Russian ambassador?
No, I didn't. I fired him because of what he said to Mike Pence. Very simple. Mike was doing his job. He was calling countries and his counterparts. So it certainly would have been okay with me if he did it. I would have directed him to do it if I thought he wasn't doing it. I didn't direct him, but I would have directed him because that's his job.
And then there was this.
If we could get along with Russia, that's a positive thing. We have a very talented man, Rex Tillerson, who's going to be meeting with them shortly. And I told him, I said, I know politically it's probably not good for me. Hey, the greatest thing I could do is shoot that ship that's 30 miles offshore right out of the water. Everyone in this country is going to say, oh, it's so great. That's not great. I would love to be able to get along with Russia.
Okay, let's get some perspective on this seemingly new era of Russia-U.S. relations under Trump. For that, we turn to Arkady Ostrovsky. He's the Russia editor for The Economist. First question, what does Russia's Vladimir Putin want out of President Trump's time in office?
There are practical things that Putin might want, lifting sanctions against Russia, which were imposed after Russia annexed Crimea and started a war in Ukraine. Russia wants investment from American companies. Most importantly, Russia wants the U.S. to get out of its backyard, to stop preaching, to stop interfering.
So essentially, Vladimir Putin wanted to keep the old kind of Cold War era boundaries of influence and felt that the U.S. was pushing its way in.
Yes. The thing that Putin cares most of all, of course, is his own hold on power. And seeing neighboring countries, which were former Soviet republics, go in the direction of the West, go in the direction of democratic systems reforming themselves, was, as far as he was concerned, setting a terrible example.
Let's get back to Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin in terms of their own relationship. I mean, some people have called it a bromance. Is that fair?
Well, there is certainly a very strong degree of kinship between these two men. And some of the things that they've done in each of their countries are strikingly similar, both in terms of the use of the media and post-fact reality lying about things and not just getting away with it, but not being even particularly embarrassed or bothered by that. And of course, most of all, doing away with all the niceties of the human rights, liberal order, all those things.
We heard recently from some Russian journalists who told us President Trump is very popular among Russians. How true is that?
Certainly the state media and practically all television is state controlled has gone out of their way to hail Trump's presidency and to praise him and to present him as the first sort of honest leader. There is an irony, breaking from the cynicism and hypocrisy of the elites. And also the Russian people, although have been brainwashed a lot over the past years, are now very confused. Only a few months ago, they were told that America is Russia's greatest enemy. Only a few months ago, they were saying that all the sanctions and all the economic problems Russia was having were due to America, and Russia was a besieged fortress, and America was trying to get it. Suddenly, they are told, Trump is a great thing. So you can excuse Russians
to be confused.
I
was going to ask is whether a kind of bromance and friendly talk deprives President Putin of a useful enemy in the West. Doesn't that kind of affect Putin's own standing among his people?
It does. Anti-Americanism, absolutely it does. And Russia can't quite afford to lose America as an enemy. America as an enemy justified a lot of things that happened in Russia. So when the economy is not doing well, you can blame it in America and people say, okay, well, we have to tighten our belts and just do the best we can because we are in confrontation with the most powerful country in the world. Now, if you're not in confrontation with the most powerful country in the world, it's not entirely clear why your pension has been cut or inflation goes up. So it does present a problem of a narrative, a propaganda problem for the Kremlin. I think the Kremlin was hoping that the benefits of Trump presidency as sort of praising Putin, praising Russia, and recognizing it as a great, great power, as President Trump would say, would outweigh the loss of America as an enemy. But certainly there is a lot of confusion and there is a lot of sort of conflict between these different narratives.
Arkady Ostrovsky is Russia editor for The Economist, and he's the author of The Invention of Russia. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Immigration was another big topic at Trump's press conference today. He said he's keeping his promise to come down hard on sanctuary cities. Those are cities in the U.S. where local law enforcement is told not to go out of its way to enforce federal immigration laws. It's part of Trump's push to increase deportations. He's also promised to shut down a program that protects immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as kids from deportation. Many of those young people are college students now, and they're asking universities to help protect them. But not everyone's on board. From Atlanta, Ashley Cleek has our story.
This was the scene at Emory earlier this month.
Sanctuary! No! Sanctuary! No!
Around 200 students and faculty demanding that Emory become a sanctuary campus to support its undocumented students. Students like Ashley Rivas Triana, class of 2020. Her family came to Georgia from Mexico illegally when she was 2.
I was very naive in thinking that, I went to, public education in the United States, I'm going to be able to go to college.
Rivas Triana soon realized how hard that'd be. Georgia is tough for undocumented students. They're barred from the state's top public universities, denied in-state tuition. Rivas Triana, though, did eventually get into Emory. It's private and accepts undocumented students. She's a freshman now, but worries how President Donald Trump's next 4 years will affect hers at school.
The national politics are definitely going to shape my time here. I can't just be a normal college student. I can't just go about my day pretending like what's happening in the world doesn't affect me.
Rivas Triana specifically fears that Trump will cancel a program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, known as DACA. It temporarily protects young people like her from deportation. If DACA goes away, Rivas Triana fears she'll have to leave the U.S. It's a worry shared by thousands of undocumented students, also mobilizing for sanctuary at over 100 campuses across the U.S. But what is a sanctuary campus?
A sanctuary campus is a place where all students are free to live and learn without fear, but also not have to worry about persecution, either from other people at the university, in the state, or from the government.
That's how Emiko Soltis defines it. She's an Emory alum helping lead the sanctuary movement. And while the idea of sanctuary varies from campus to campus, at Emory, Soltis says, it means this: admitting all qualified undocumented students, offering them mental and legal support, and here's the big one:
to pledge lawful non-cooperation with federal immigration authorities, meaning that if they're going to come to campus or interact with the students, that they have to have a judicial warrant in order to do so.
Not cooperating with immigration agents, that's not an option, says Georgia Representative Earl Earhart. He's introduced a bill to block state funding to universities that declare themselves sanctuaries. Earhart didn't respond to interview requests, but Christian Zim did. He leads Emory's Republican Club and supports Earhart's bill.
I'm in favor of it because it's the law of the land. It's about time that we start taking undocumented immigrants very seriously.
Seriously, as in not letting them enroll in universities. At the same time, Zim says, he understands why some students are worried.
I feel their concerns, and they have every right to be concerned that way. But I would tell them that it's just not, it probably won't happen.
So Zim thinks that the fear is overblown, that immigration agents won't suddenly descend on campuses looking for undocumented immigrants. That, though, is still unknown and has the fight for sanctuary campuses intensifying and forcing university presidents to respond. Claire Stirk, Emory's president, is drawing cautious lines seen at other universities. She says DACA students can still enroll and she'll follow privacy laws to protect their personal information. But she says she won't stop the university from cooperating with immigration authorities. That could jeopardize millions in state funding. Also, Trump and Congress have threatened to sanction universities, trying to block immigration officials. Meanwhile, on Emory's campus, professors like Christine Restaino, who teaches Italian, feel torn over sanctuary.
It feels as though no matter what we choose, we cannot guarantee that things will be okay.
Restaino says she knows undocumented students who fear this debate puts them in the spotlight.
It's a beautiful thing to do. Symbolically, it's beautiful. But the reality is, will that make our students less safe?
Rivas Triana, the freshman who's undocumented, knows some students are afraid. But she says this:
there needs to be someone that needs to be not afraid of the consequences, because ultimately, this is the right and just thing to do. And it really sends a message to the entire country that this is what we stand for.
She says she has no choice but to speak out, and she wants her university to stand with her. For The World, Ashley Cleek, Atlanta, Georgia.
Coming up, Trump gets asked about rising anti-Semitism again, and again, he fails to denounce it. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. President Donald Trump has had two press appearances in the space of 2 days, and both times he was asked about rising anti-Semitism in the U.S. that seems to coincide with his own political rise. Here's how the president responded today as he criticized the reporter who asked the question.
Number one, I am the least anti-Semitic person that you've ever seen in your entire life. Number two, racism. The least racist person. In fact, we did very well relative to other people running as a Republican. Quiet, quiet, quiet. See, he lied about he was going to get up and ask a very straight, simple question. So, you know, welcome to the world of the media.
Yesterday, during his appearance with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump talked about his Jewish daughter and grandchildren. What he didn't do was denounce anti-Semitism. Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
The Anti-Defamation League has been tracking anti-Semitism in this country for a century. Speaking from his office in New York City, CEO Jonathan Greenblatt says there's been a surge of incidents in recent months, and these aren't just people posting insensitive comments on Facebook.
I'm talking about bomb threats at preschools. I'm talking about getting messages sent to you telling you that, you know, I got one yesterday telling me they were coming to put me in the oven.
Swastikas spray-painted at schools, synagogues vandalized, and in the past 6 months, bomb threats sent to 48 different Jewish community centers in 26 states and Canada. The anti-Jewish haters have clearly been emboldened, Greenblatt says. But when Trump was asked about it yesterday, Greenblatt says the president failed to categorically denounce anti-Semitism.
It would be easy to simply say in no uncertain terms, America is no place for hate. You know, based on our polling, just under 10% or maybe just over 10% of the American people have anti-Semitic attitudes. That's pretty low in historical terms, but the issue is that now many appear to be acting on it. They feel the environment, if not encouraging it, at least isn't discouraging it in an explicit way, and that's a problem.
Trump's non-answer yesterday didn't surprise James Kirchick. He's the author of The End of Europe and a conservative columnist for The Daily Beast. Kirchick is no fan of Donald Trump. Going back almost a year, he described Trump as the candidate of the mob, meaning he's a populist who whips up vague conspiracy theories about minorities. And the mob, Kirchick says, always ends up turning on the Jews.
If you look throughout history, I think movements that are based on conspiracy theory, that are based on hatred of the sort of vague notion of elites without really defining who they are, that target minority groups, it doesn't have to start with Jews, but it will eventually end with Jews, because it's the kind of logic of that thinking that is constantly in need of enemies to blame societal ills upon.
Trump got about 25% of the Jewish vote. That's not much less than Mitt Romney did. So there is clearly a segment of American Jews who support what the new administration is doing. Benjamin Netanyahu tried to put the anti-Semitism question to rest yesterday. He said there is no better friend of the Jewish people than Donald Trump. Rabbi Jill Jacobs is not persuaded, though. She's with the Jewish human rights group Trua, and she says the biblical story of Joseph has relevance for American Jews today.
Joseph believes that if he establishes a close relationship with Pharaoh, that he'll be able to protect his family. And it works for a couple of generations. Joseph has a close relationship with Pharaoh. His family is fed and protected during a famine in Egypt. But then as soon as that Pharaoh dies, that relationship falls away and the Jews are put into slavery.
Trump certainly didn't invent anti-Jewish bigotry, Jacobs says, but he is also failing to take a clear and forceful stand against it. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Trump's pick for ambassador to Israel began his confirmation process in the Senate this morning, and the first thing David Friedman did was express regret for what he called his inflammatory language during the election campaign. He didn't specify what that language was, but it probably included the word capo. In an opinion piece, Friedman called supporters of J Street, a liberal Jewish American lobby group, worse than capos. He said, they're just smug advocates of Israel's destruction, delivered from the comfort of their secure American sofas. J Street opposes settlement activity in the West Bank. Now, capo is a German word, and it's a reference to the Holocaust. I asked Stephen Cohen to clarify. He's a professor of Jewish social policy at Hebrew Union College in New York City.
It refers to prisoners of the Nazi concentration camps who worked on behalf of the Nazis in administrative tasks and in controlling the prisoners. And obviously, there also were Jews who took on this function and are seen as the most despicable example of treachery and disloyalty to the Jewish people known in kind of the internal lexicon of the Jewish language, although, of course, with some sympathy, because they, too, were prisoners, and many of them were slain in the Holocaust, in the what Jews call the Shoah.
So, but how does his use of this word, David Friedman's use of the word capo, hasn't it kind of provoked American Jews to think one way or the other about him, or has he stepped over the line in using that word?
Well, most Jews would. We haven't done a poll on this thing, but I would imagine most Jews, if asked, would say that he has. In that, on the one hand, he is accusing left of center pro-Israel Jews of being disloyal or traitors or worse. And on the other hand, in addition, he is dipped into Holocaust-related language. And there's another principle in Jewish life and in Jewish rhetoric that you don't play games and you don't appropriate the Holocaust for, let's call it profane purposes. The Holocaust is seen as a very holy and sacred terrain. And so not only did he cross the line in terms of using inflammatory language against the opponents of the government of Israel. But he then used what many would regard as an obscene usage, appropriating Holocaust language in order to make that point.
David Friedman has been Trump's lawyer for many years. He has no prior diplomatic experience. His views on Israel lean to the far right. He's talked before about supporting a one-state solution. How do you think his appointment would affect relations among American Jews? Do you think it would be general support, or would there be a kind of ambivalence about him?
Oh, I don't think we would find support or ambivalence. I think we would see outright condemnation and opposition. There's a long line of scholarly evidence, a lot of which I've collected, that shows that American Jews are both committed to Israel and have policies that align both with the minority, the opposition in Israel, the left opposition, and in American politics, they went roughly three quarters against Donald Trump, reflecting longstanding loyalties to the liberal camp and the Democratic Party. So David Friedman would be persona non grata in most Jewish audiences, and every pronouncement he would make would be seen as suspect, if not actually offensive.
Stephen Cohen is professor of Jewish social policy at Hebrew Union College in New York. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
News headlines are on the way. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. Immigrants in several U.S. cities are staying home from work and school today to show how important they are to their communities. We'll hear from an immigrant business owner who supports the action.
This is the time not to sit on the sideline and watch what's happening, but really to get engaged.
What a day without immigrants is all about. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. President Trump lashed out at the news media, Democrats, and just about everyone else in the room today at a testy press conference in Washington. He boasted about all his administration has accomplished in less than a month. And on issues like immigration, Trump said he's only following through on his campaign promises.
Some people are so surprised that we're having strong borders. Well, that's what I've been talking about for a year and a half, strong borders. They're so surprised. Oh, he having strong borders. Well, that's what I've been talking about to the press and to everybody else.
Trump may have been trying to flex some muscle today, but so too were immigrants in America, or at least some of them. Estimates suggest thousands stayed away from their jobs, closed their businesses, or offered a portion of their profits for an event billed as the Day Without Immigrants. Andy Shalal, owner of Busboys and Poets Restaurants in D.C., shut down all six of his establishments. I asked him if that was a tough decision financially.
Well, it was and it wasn't. I think, as an immigrant myself, I felt an obligation to stand in solidarity with the rest of my staff, who was very, very much, of course, keen on doing it. This is a grassroots effort that started. No one really knows where, but it didn't take long to take off. This is the time not to sit on the sideline and watch what's happening, but really to get engaged.
Andy, how many people do you employ?
We have about 650 employees.
And how many are immigrants?
You know, we really don't know. I guess in a way, all of us are immigrants at some point or another. It's hard to tell who's an immigrant and who is not, and who's been here for a short time and who's been here for a while.
I'm wondering, shutting down businesses, immigrant-run businesses, could it also hurt the very people who it's trying to help? I mean, I'm thinking maybe a single mom who's working at a fast food joint or a day laborer. They might have something bigger to lose in terms of day wages. What about that scenario?
Everyone really is going to use their conscience to be able to do what they have to do. I think people recognize that the fear that has been instilled in people in the past few weeks, the raids that are happening, are creating a huge amount of hardships. And so it's not a huge price to pay sometimes to lose a day's work.
So are all of your employees getting paid for the day off?
For many of our employees, they have earned leave. So we have paid sick leave and we have paid vacations and time off, and they're encouraged to use any of those.
Give us a sense of some of the immigrants who work for you. What are their lives like?
Many of them come from South America and Central America. Many of them come from Europe. They come from Africa. They come from Asia. They come from all over the world. So, their stories are varied. I know that, for instance, I have a woman that works here who's a host. She's been with me for about 7 years. She works almost nonstop, like literally day and night oftentimes. And she sends money back to her daughter, whom she hasn't seen for 7 years, because of policies that make it impossible for her to see her daughter. So that's one of the issues that we want to highlight during this day without immigrants, is to talk about immigration reform. We need to really sit down as a society and decide which side of history are we going to be on. We're facing one of the largest human catastrophes we've ever experienced in the world, with people being displaced all over the world. I come from a country of 25 million people, Iraq, and there were 5 million people that have been displaced. Many of them have become refugees twice and three times over. Many of them moved to Syria, and then Syria went under, and they had to move somewhere else. So it's really been disturbing for me when we start talking about such xenophobic terms and using the immigrants as a fodder for political advancement.
And of course, as an immigrant from Iraq, that's one of the countries in President Trump's immigration ban. Does this feel personal to you?
It feels very personal. My wife is from Iran, so we're both on the ban, so to speak. We're both American citizens. We've been here for a long time, and we feel American, you know. But at moments like these, when suddenly you really feel like an outsider, it doesn't feel very good. I know that my wife had planned to go back to Iran. She usually goes there during the spring because that's the Iranian New Year. She decided this year to go before President Trump became president because she said once he got elected, it was going to be difficult to see what's going to happen. So she went during December just because she didn't want to be humiliated coming back. She didn't want to be detained. She didn't want to be held back because on her passport, even though it's an American passport, it says born in Iran. So these are very, very tiny things. They compare nothing to the hardships that people are facing during this last round of executive orders that cause so much chaos for people that are waiting in airports. And these are people that have saved a lifetime to be able to get across here. They have to pay for airline ticket or a boat ride or something to be able to get across here. And once they're here, they're told, no, we've changed our mind. We can't accept you now. Well, these are folks that are not going to be able to check in at a Four Seasons hotel and wait for somebody else to do something.
But at the end of the day, what will a one-day protest of shutting down immigrant-run businesses do?
So much comes out of these one-day events. I mean, look at the Women's March that happened on January the 21st after the inauguration. It started out with a grandmother in Hawaii who said, you know what, I can't sit here. We need a march. And by the time she woke up the next morning, there were thousands of people who are sharing it and liking it and doing all that on Facebook. Hundreds of thousands of women showed up. Well, you might say it's just one day, but so many organizations have sprouted from that one gathering. When somebody is hurt, you know, we're all going to stand up. Either we all rise together or we fall apart, and we're not going to let this happen.
Andy Shalal owns the Busboys and Poets Restaurants in Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot, Andy.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
President Trump's travel ban and the ongoing immigration raids have many here scared. So scared, in fact, that some immigrants are packing up and fleeing north to Canada. And that's where the world's Rupa Shenoy is. Rupa, you're in Toronto. Tell us about the people who've been coming over and how they're crossing the border. What are the conditions like?
They're being driven across the border and pretty much dumped in parks. They end up not knowing where they are, and it's very cold. They're not dressed for the cold, and they're not used to the cold because they come from places where it doesn't get cold. We're at a free clinic where these refugees are treated. So by the time they get to the free clinic, they have frostbite, hypothermia, and they're dehydrated. They told us a story of a woman whose hands froze because she was putting them on her child, and she didn't realize how cold they were getting until they didn't work anymore. And more of these people are coming. The doctor here, Paul Colford, has been working with refugees for 20 years, and he says he's seen a sudden spike.
All of the people we've seen are women and children, and they've all had cold journeys in the back of trucks to save their lives, literally, by fleeing from, if you can believe this, the United States of America. And they've just fled from sub-Saharan Africa, and in our case, they're Nigerian, almost exclusively. And again, almost exclusively women and children fleeing enormous, dire, deadly, dangerous consequences back in their home nations.
Rupa, are the migrants heading into Canada people who were in the U.S. for just a short time or a long time? I'm just curious if there's a general theme to who the migrants are who are heading to Canada in this tough time of year.
Well, some of them are people who were denied asylum in the United States and are trying again in Canada. Some of them are people who are just worried about Trump's policies and feel like they won't be treated fairly in the justice system if they apply for asylum or continue their proceedings. And others are coming from their home countries. They paid a lot of money to an agent who brought them through other countries, perhaps the United States as well, and then into Canada.
What's the Canadian government's response to this? Will they be changing the policy to help people cross more safely?
So far, they say they're looking at the policy, but they haven't said that they would change it. Although there is a lot of public pressure to allow refugees to come in through official border crossings and be able to apply for asylum. Right now, they're just dealing with the immediate problem, finding people, getting them shelter and health care. And there's a lot of pride here that they're able to provide this support. They say it's the Canadian way. You know, people are showing up, they need help, and it's just what Canadians do. They help people.
It's the right thing to do on a number of fronts. The most important reason is for the depth of difficulty and the needs of the folks that we're seeing, the refugees we're seeing. The public support it's been top of mind for a lot of the public. And the public support for the work we're doing has suggested something else. It's suggested and confirmed that I believe we are a compassionate nation.
We'll be learning more about this story tomorrow. Rupa, what's coming up?
Tonight we're going to meet some of these refugees at a clinic, a health clinic, where they all go for treatment. So we'll have that for you tomorrow.
The World's Rupa Shenoy in Toronto. Thanks, Rupa.
Thank you.
Let's head someplace a bit warmer now. Cuba. Lots of change on the island these days. And this week, reporter Deepa Fernandez has been telling us about it. Deepa lived in Cuba 2 decades ago. Back then, she chronicled the lives of women. Recently, she went back to find some of them again to see how their lives and Cuba have changed. Today, Deepa brings us the story of a retired professor whose family lost land when Fidel's revolution triumphed.
When I made a documentary about Ilda 2 decades ago, she was in her 40s, a happily married mother of two.
Well, as a human being, the revolution has given me nothing material. Because I come from a family of landowners. So the revolution took things away from us. That's from the economic point of view. However, I feel that the revolution has given women, well, it's given me a university course.
She became an English professor at the University of Havana and loved her job. So much so that she stuck with it even in the 90s, Cuba's deep economic crisis, when, as an English speaker, she could have earned so much more money in the burgeoning tourist sector. But Ilda kept teaching at the University of Havana until recently.
I retired, and I feel very well about it because I am working as a volunteer.
She volunteers at a local church, which kind of surprised me because when I knew Ilda 2 decades ago, she was not religious.
I had been raised as a Catholic. We still believe, but we were not churchgoers. We had an utopia, the Marxist utopia. In a way, it was like a religion. We believed strongly that things were going to be great, that we were going to build a better world, and that sort of took the place of the church.
Her church work focuses on water filtration projects so Cubans can have clean drinking water. She also teaches English for free to her neighbors.
So Maricel is absent and Mara is absent too.
When I knew Ilda, she was one of the first to rent a room in her home to foreigners, a way to supplement her state income.
So you think you're ready for role-playing?
Now everybody on her block does it.
Okay, mother and daughter, more natural, more natural.
It's mostly women in their 60s and 70s attending this training to learn some basic English and also the fine cultural points of renting rooms to, well, sometimes demanding foreigners.
I am your lonely. Landlady. I am your landlady.
Okay.
Since the 1959 revolution, Cubans mostly all earned the same amount of income, be you a doctor, a university professor, or a bank clerk.
Now it's another very different story. The people who own restaurants or the people who rent houses or apartments, they're getting much more income than those who live on a government salary.
How does that make you feel?
We're doing better. We feel we're indebted because we were made by the revolution. There is this contrast that for us it's very shocking. For my generation, the young people think differently sometimes. They believe that's the way it has to be because what we tried to build was fiction, they say. It didn't work. It was very beautiful, but not possible.
Hilda's son and daughter are both doing very well too. Her son runs one of the best restaurants in Havana, and her daughter studied information technology and works for a Spanish company. Both live right next door to her.
Many, many young people in Cuba have left, looking for better economic possibilities. That's a fact. Yeah, I'm a little selfish. I love to have them here, yeah. I'm very proud of both of them, to tell you the truth. And I always tell them, I'm getting older. You are my investment. Now you have to take care of me in the future.
Hilda recently had a cancer scare, but she went through chemo and radiation, and she beat it.
Things are going fine, and I'm living my full life.
Everyone in her neighborhood knows her, from the older guy two blocks away who tends to drink too much and hang out on the street. She's so kind to him, most just pass him by. And there's her shoe repair guy.
It's a different way of thinking. Here we want everything to last forever.
And back to the place where she's most alive and inspired. Her kitchen.
Plantains in temptation, which is you don't fry them but just make them golden.
For the world, Deepa Fernandez, Havana.
You can hear more about Hilda in a documentary Deepa made for our partners at the BBC. We have that link at PRI.org. Time for an update now on the mysterious death of Kim Jong-nam. Kim was the estranged half-brother of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. And on Monday, he suddenly fell ill at the airport in the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur, and later died. Malaysian authorities have arrested three suspects, two women and a man. One of the suspects, a woman with Vietnamese travel documents, appeared in court today. Anna Fifield is in Kuala Lumpur, reporting on the story for The Washington Post.
Well, we don't know what happened inside the courtroom today. There were no reporters in there. But there have been reports from the police here that once they picked up the first woman, the Vietnamese woman, that she had said to them that she didn't know what she was doing. She was tricked into it, and she thought that she was playing a prank on a man in the airport. And it was only later she realized that she had been duped into playing a role in this. So it sounds like she didn't realize what she was doing. And it seems quite an amateur operation from her point of view. She was later abandoned by the others involved in the operation and simply went back to the terminal where the attack took place and tried to board a plane to Vietnam. And that's how she got picked up.
You've been trying to get reaction from North Korean officials in Malaysia. What are they saying?
They're saying absolutely nothing, funnily enough. I went to the North Korean embassy here today, and it's a kind of a house in a set back from the road. There's a big gate and a driveway, and they have actually removed the button from the buzzer at the gate so that journalists cannot press the buzzer and ask pesky questions. So they're really trying to stop them there. There were some journalists outside, and I stood outside for a while. I saw a North Korean man drive in and get out, and I, you know, shouted some questions through the gate, but he just ignored us and went inside. So the North Koreans have said absolutely nothing about this. The Malaysian authorities today said that they have been talking to the North Koreans here and that they had confirmed that Kim Jong-nam was traveling with two passports, one under his real name and one under this alias. So the North Koreans have confirmed to the Malaysians that this really is Kim Jong-nam who was killed.
And has there been an autopsy that revealed anything specific?
There has been an autopsy, but the results have not been released. So this was controversial from the outset. The North Korean diplomats here actually tried to stop the Malaysians from carrying out an autopsy. They objected to it and said they wanted the body back. But the Malaysians said that there's a procedure to be followed, and they went through and completed the autopsy, but they have not released the findings yet.
Remind us how Kim Jong-nam died. What did he inhale, or what was he sprayed with?
Right, so he was in the budget carrier terminal at Kuala Lumpur Airport checking in for a flight to Macau when these two young women in their 20s approached him, and apparently one of them grabbed his arms, and the other one sprayed some kind of chemical onto his face and then held a handkerchief or some kind of cloth over his face for about 10 seconds. And then they both left, not in any huge hurry, I might say. They went down like three escalators and got waited in a line for a taxi. But during this time, Kim Jong-nam began to feel dizzy, and he kind of staggered over to the reception counter there in the airport terminal and asked for help. By the time they got him to the clinic inside the terminal, he was basically kind of passing out, and they bundled him into an ambulance, but he died on the way to hospital. But this terminal is so busy at this time of the morning and so chaotic that even the people working in the cafe just a few meters away from where this attack took place were completely unaware of what had happened. They said they didn't notice any kind of chaos or anything unusual at the time.
One of our big questions is, why would Kim Jong-un, the current leader of North Korea, want his half-brother Kim Jong-nam murdered?
Well, that's a very good question, because Kim Jong-nam has been living outside of North Korea for more than 15 years. He doesn't seem to have any kind of political ambitions, that doesn't pay much interest in North Korea by the sounds of things. But Kim Jong-un has systematically been getting rid of any potential rivals over the 5 years since he's been in power. But, you know, he famously had his uncle executed 3 years ago and has dispatched many other senior officials since then. So the theory is that Kim Jong-un has decided to take out his brother to avoid him becoming a potential replacement for him in the future. And there may be something to that, because China had been protecting Kim Jong-nam while he was in Beijing. And there's a theory that the Chinese had always wanted to keep Kim Jong-nam in reserve, ready to install him in Pyongyang if things got out of hand with Kim Jong-un, his brother and the current leader, because Kim Jong-un has not been particularly friendly to China.
Now, I know there were celebrations in Pyongyang today. They're marking the day former leader Kim Jong-il was born. How much will ordinary North Koreans even know about Kim Jong-nam's murder?
Ordinary North Koreans don't even know that Kim Jong-nam exists. Officially in North Korea, he does not exist at all, because he is the love child of Kim Jong-il and his consort or partner at the time. They were never officially married, and their relationship was never officially announced because Kim Jong-il's father did not approve of it. So even as a child, Kim Jong-nam lived in secret in North Korea up until the age of about 8, and then he was sent off, and he grew up in Moscow and Geneva, leading a very kind of lonely existence by the sound of it. And then even when he was 18 and returned to Pyongyang, he wasn't allowed to go out, or wasn't even allowed to go to their beach resort on the coast. Very often he had this very secretive existence. So there's never been a mention of Kim Jong-nam in the official North Korean media, and there certainly won't be a mention now of his death.
Anna Fifield, reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Kuala Lumpur. Thanks, Anna.
Thanks for having me on, Carol.
Finally today, I've got a question for you. Have you ever wanted to be a Korean pop music star? No, me neither. But if I did, there's a school in New York that promises to be my ticket to stardom, a place where non-Koreans can get a crash course in K-pop. And it's not just about learning the songs and the dance moves. You got to learn Korean.
It's actually my hardest challenge because my Korean sucks.
That would seem to be a major obstacle. More on that story tomorrow. And that's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.